I think here we have, so this is the group that can't get enough of business cycle theory, so you just keep coming. Everything has business cycles in the title. I know that such people exist because I was one of those people. Right? Business cycles, yes, I'm there. Okay, so what I'd like to talk about today is some about error and the way that it plays into business cycle theory, and then implications of that fact when we start thinking about government stimulus, because inevitably, any time a recession starts, right, we start hearing, oh, we have to do something, and that something always involves cutting a bunch of taxes, running huge deficits, and naturally spending a lot of money on various projects. So first, I want to start out by just claiming that every business cycle theory, regardless the adjective you want to put in front of it, is ultimately going to be a theory of error. In the end, every business cycle theory is a theory of error. And we find this is actually something that the mainstream also kind of has come to accept over the past couple decades. Okay, so first, let's talk a little bit about where errors come from and different views of that. Okay. In the mainstream, I find that there are really three main theories of error that we see in the models that are used. The first would be the perfect foresight model. Perfect foresight basically would claim that errors do not exist, right? That every decision we make, we have a perfect knowledge of what's going to happen in the future, and we make decisions rationally based on that information. Now, nobody really believes in perfect foresight, as far as I know. If they do, I would like to see their crystal ball, right? And nobody believes in perfect foresight, but as is often the case, we say, well, this is a good benchmark against which we can measure things. So if we had perfect foresight, this is how things would work. That's not how things work, so we must not have perfect foresight. Okay, fair enough. Two other much more believed options. One would be rational expectations. Rational expectations claims that any errors arise really just from the fact that we don't have all of the information that would be relevant to making a decision. Right? This is actually the foundation of the efficient markets hypothesis, right, which claims basically that stock market prices are correct, that is, they reflect all available relevant information, right, making it impossible for you to find a good deal on the stock market. And so rational expectations, if there are errors in that system, it must be that there's some kind of information that's useful but that we just don't have. Right? Typically, if you have a model based on rational expectations, there's some kind of exogenous shock to the system. Right? So there's some random thing out there. We can kind of guess what the average is. We don't know specifically what the value of it's going to be over time. Right? Often in real business cycle theory, something that I've had a lot of exposure to in graduate school, there the claim would be that productivity is this kind of thing. We can guess the average level of productivity over time, but we don't know how it's going to progress precisely. As, you know, we make technological discoveries. You can't really predict advances in knowledge, right? Or we'd already have the knowledge. Right? So it's something that's unpredictable, and as a result, we get errors because of that. A third possibility, which being the second that people may actually believe, is adaptive expectations. This would claim that expectations are formed on the basis of what we've observed in the past. Right? So I might, just as a simple example, if somebody asks me, oh, what are inflation rates going to look like, say, for the consumer price index for the next year? Right? If I'm very naive in my adaptive expectations, I might take the average over the past 10 years and say, yeah, it's going to be something like this, say 3% or 2.5%, something like that. So in this case, error can arise largely in two ways. Right? One would be maybe there's information that's just not available to you. The second would be maybe there's information that's available that you just ignore. Right? You don't think that it's important, even if it might actually be important in determining whatever it is you're trying to predict. And so these three different mainstream views, either no errors at all, or errors arising from just an unpredictable nature of reality, or from the fact that we ignore things that might actually make nature more predictable, but for whatever reason, we don't find it worthwhile. Well, one thing I would note is that both rational expectations and adaptive expectations we see used by Austrians at times. Mises actually, in The Theory of Money and Credit, uses both at different parts in the book. Right? At one point, when you look at the regression theorem, he really talks a lot about what basically is adaptive expectations. Right? How do I know what the value of money will be in the future? Well, I look at the immediate past and say, okay, I know there are things happening. It may modify this a bit, but certainly I'm informed by the immediate past when I think about the future value of money. But Mises also mentions rational expectations when he's talking about, the effectiveness of monetary stimulus in causing booms. And he suggests that if entrepreneurs all figured out the way this worked, right, that is, if we had good information about the way the business cycle worked, that in fact we wouldn't see the Austrian business cycle theory any business cycle occur anymore, and that people would adjust to it as if we actually had that information and thought about it properly. And so both rational and adaptive expectations we see used by Mises himself. Austrian views, then, turning toward that, I'm adopting here a topology that comes from Guido Holzmann's paper written several years ago, his General Theory of Error Cycles. I thought it was a very interesting paper when I read it. I think I'm coming to agree with it less and less over time. I guess that happens. Right? But he says that really in the Austrian literature, you have two different views out there. One is the view that he advocates and is claiming to originate there, is that we should really consider error to just be a given, right? That it's not something that we can really explain on the basis of human action. And to a certain degree, I think we have to agree with him on that, that people do not set out to make errors, right? Can't say, okay, we know that people act and therefore errors occur. That doesn't actually follow. It's very difficult to get that to try to follow. Right. So he says we should just treat error as something that's given. And then instead of asking questions, as say I might, like how do errors happen, right, he said don't even ask the questions. It's not worth it. Right. Just accept that they happen and then ask what are the implications of that. Right. If we know that errors happen, then what? And he also suggests that another very important question to ask be, are there institutions that exist that are inherently erroneous, where there's some sort of internal contradiction, where they just cannot possibly succeed? They, in fact, are inherently erroneous. And he points, shockingly enough, to government as being an inherently erroneous institution, right, that is going to cause problems. The other view that Holzmann talks about would be the consequentialist view, which I think is much more common amongst Austrians. And that is that we try to explain errors. We say that there are conditions that arise, right, that make errors more likely to happen. Right? And we use this type of reasoning to explain, right, that cluster of errors that leads to Austrian business cycles. Okay. So under this set of people, right, how do we explain, right, errors that happen? I really like to think of this in terms of a very important question. I really like to think of this as saying, how do we explain the fact that this peak right here, right, actually exists? For this is the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It just kind of give a view of the housing bubble that happened here in the U.S. Right, right. How do we explain that peak? Because it's very easy, I find, for many economists to throw a set of prices up on the board and to forget what the price actually is. Right? And that these prices actually reflect real people that are deciding to go out and buy homes at prices that are reflected here. Right? So there are people that have decided that they are, in fact, going to buy homes at prices that are reflected here. Okay. Now, why would somebody do this, right, if there is following right afterward, right, this huge collapse along the lines of, what is that, 30% in roughly a year in housing prices? This is somewhat difficult to explain without errors being made. Hey, I know I generally try not to buy things that I know are going to lose 30% of their value. Perfect foresight is out. Right? And now we could take the rational expectations approach. Maybe something weird happened. Right? Suddenly everybody decided to hate housing over the course of that year. But that also is unsatisfying. Right? Like, it's one thing for me to criticize the weatherman if, say, he says, well, we probably aren't going to have rain today, and then we get light showers. Okay, this happens. It's another thing for him to say, well, we're probably not going to get rain today, and then the hurricane hits the coast, and here we are drenched. Right? We should see the monsoon coming even if we don't see the shower coming. And to many people, this feels like a monsoon. Right? We should be able to see this coming, potentially, one might think. So why don't we? Why are people making these errors, right, here at the very peak, going out buying houses that are outrageously highly priced compared to what they will be in just the next year or so? Right. And I would say I have a lot of experience with error, a lot of practice. When I bought my house, there was not one of them. Right? I just bought my house very recently, and the people that bought it before me certainly made an error, and that I paid them slightly less than they paid for the house 10 years ago. And they added a pool in the time that they had it. So now I'm planning to tear the pool out because I don't want my 2.5-year-old too close to the pool. But okay. Right. The point being, they probably made an error. I don't think they thought, oh, in the next 10 years, we're going to have no appreciation. In fact, a very slight depreciation of the value of the home. Right. There's an error there that happened. And I think this was very common and exceptionally common, right, amongst those that are buying homes right here. Okay. So why did this happen? Right. Why do people invest in a bubble at the very peak? Well, there are lots of possible explanations, right? One is that maybe foresight is just hard. Right? It's just difficult to tell the future. Nobody has a perfectly clear crystal ball, right? So we make mistakes, right? And like I said, I've made my share of mistakes. In college, I was potentially one of the worst investors in existence. It seemed like the best way to predict a company would go bankrupt was that I would buy it, right? Because seriously, one after another, I would buy this company and they'd file for bankruptcy and you know, all the money that I put in. I actually have an account with Ameritrade right now that has $1.19 left in it. Because literally every company that I had in it went bankrupt over the course of when I was in college. And okay, we make errors. Foresight is hard, right? Obviously, I'm not very good at it. Right? But I'd suggest that's not a very good explanation, right, for the peak. After all, foresight is hard also suggests that we should make errors the other way, right? And that sometimes things turn out much better than we expect, right? That's not what happens at the peak. At the peak, the grand majority of people are wrong going forward. That is, we are all overly optimistic about the future. And that's a strange thing to happen. You would think that some people would be overly pessimistic, some people overly optimistic. We divide in this way. But that's not what happens at the peak. Another possibility, which is suggested by Walter Block and probably others as well, is that the low interest rates that occur during the boom in the Austrian business cycle theory are basically a bribe to make investments. Right? We're making these long-range investments look very cheap, look very attractive, so we're bribing people to make these types of investments, which is possible. I still feel somewhat odd about that happening right there at the peak. Another argument that's out there is by Crilly and Dempster. They made several years ago, where they suggested that while it's true that all of us hopping in and investing in these long-range projects caused the business cycle, which is a bad thing, individually, though, right, as I participate in the cycle, say, starting down here, right, we're buying into the housing boom. There's a lot of money to be made as we appreciate the price of the home, something on the order of 100%, right? There's a lot of money to be made there. Right? So it may be that privately we all have this incentive to go ahead and invest in the bubble, despite the fact that it will eventually undo itself. Right? I have a few problems with their argument. Some I'll talk about tomorrow on the game theoretic basis that they make, I think is a little bit shaky. But I still think it's very problematic with that peak. Doesn't explain the peak. At the peak, there really isn't any money to be made going forward, at least buying properties. So I suggest that probably the best explanation, and who I would side myself with, would be Baxendale and Evans. They suggest that when you have a monetary expansion, right, one of the consequences is lower interest rates, but another consequence is we have to go out and find new people to borrow money that would not normally be able to get that money. After all, if we're doing a credit expansion, we need to make more loans in order to push interest rates down. So now we have to expand who is it that's going to qualify for a loan. Now we know, just anecdotally, that this did happen during the housing boom. Right? People coming in, no signs of any income or that they could possibly even earn an income, no real assets necessarily to speak of, and okay, we give you a loan, go out and buy a house. Right? Okay, so there does seem to be some anecdotal evidence of that. I'd also suggest that that helps somewhat to explain the peak, right? If you're somebody that normally can't get a loan, right, what type of foresight might you have, right? Probably, I would suggest not very good foresight, right? Normally, I think that banks are generally pretty good at sorting out the relatively high-quality entrepreneurs, those that can foresee fairly well, that are going to start businesses and buy homes that actually appreciate in value. Sorting those from those that are relatively low quality, right, that are probably going to make worse decisions. Right? So those that make worse decisions don't get the funding, while those that do get the funding are those we expect to make better decisions. But once we expand the basis for how many people are going to get loans, we have to start drawing in those entrepreneurs that aren't necessarily very good, right, if we're going to get those funds used. And so the way that I think we can probably explain that peak best is that we have a lot of people entering the market that normally would not be allowed to, right, that normally could not get funding, that now have it available because of the monetary expansion. And as a result, they make lots of errors precisely because they're error-prone. Put another way, at the peak, I can actually get a loan. Okay, right. Or normally, they should not give me one. Okay. I would point out here, those that have read Joseph Schumpeter, if you haven't, you're in good company, right? But those that have, this is exactly opposite what his view is. Right? His view is that the credit expansion allows us then to take resources and give them to high-quality entrepreneurs, right? Rather than the low-quality entrepreneurs that just end up with them somehow, right? I suggest he's, in fact, exactly wrong because of the filtering process that happens through bank applications. Okay, right, so errors. Right, we know that they're the foundation of the business cycle theory, and we have some explanation for how they might become more common, right, over the course of the boom, right, precisely because we have to go out and find lower quality folks to take loans as we're trying to push down interest rates through lending more. Okay. Now let's turn to talk a little bit about the role of capital. Yeah. As Professor Garrison has pointed out, right, really Austrian business cycle theory is all about distortions in the capital structure. Right? Temporarily, we end up trying to invest in ways that are not going to be sustainable once we actually reflect consumer preferences. Okay. Right, so put another way, low interest rates, right, drive us into these longer production processes. Right, we make investments in capital, especially in the early stages of these various processes. And if this isn't supplied by real savings, we also see at the same time, right, an attempt to expand consumption. Right? I don't want to save if interest rates have been pushed down. I want to consume more. So you have an increase in consumption. At the same time, we're trying to invest more in early stages. Right? We just don't have the resources to do both. Okay. Right? And in the end, this all comes unraveled, as he's described. Right? Now, the key point that I want to make here is in the Austrian capital theory, capital is heterogeneous. It is not all the same. It's very different from the standard capital theory you'd find in most business cycle theory in the mainstream. Here, I can summarize that fairly well, and I think Garrison often does too. Here we go. Turn on this camera. Let's see. There's a camera button somewhere. Maybe. Oh, input select. There we go. Ah, that's it. That's it. And the camera should actually do it with paper. With some lights. Perfect. All right. And so what I suggest, so you have something like this in standard mainstream theory. There's capital. Right. That's it, right? Is this K? Right. There we go. You see that? Okay. Just a letter K. Right? It's this blob of capital. Yeah, I really enjoy trying to figure out what are the units of capital, as Garrison does, right? Well, what is this? I like blob of capital. I think it's the most descriptive myself. And I think when you actually try to visualize it, I think the best analogy to make it concrete is that really what they imagine is something kind of like this. I'm awful at art, right? It's not actually a cloud, right? There are eyes in it. It's a very malformed potato, right? And really, we imagine in the standard theory that capital is kind of this potato, right? Which you could consume it if you wanted to, right? Bake it and eat it, right? Or you could, right, cut it up and plant each eye, and it'll grow into more potatoes in the future. And it's kind of what we imagine. Weirdly, that is actually fairly accurate to how capital is treated, right? Which isn't really true, right? We know that, for example, my son loves McDonald's. I guess he gets that from me. Right. Right, we get a Happy Meal, right? And we can consume the Happy Meal. Right? My son eats his chicken nuggets and what have you. And I can consume my cheeseburger or something like a burger that they call a cheeseburger. But I really couldn't consume the McDonald's itself. Right? It doesn't work, right? It's a little bit different, right? So capital is heterogeneous. It's not the same thing as the consumption good it produces, nor is it the same thing as other capital goods either, right? I can't go through the McDonald's and say, well, you know, could you get me a Harley Davidson, please? Right? No, we don't have the right kind of capital. Capital is heterogeneous. It is specific to the good that it is going to produce. Now, not entirely. Right? There's some capital goods that can produce lots of different things. Right? Steel goes into all kinds of different goods. But once you get into a certain shape, it becomes more specific. Right? I may use steel to make a car. I may use steel to make the chair you're sitting on. But once it's in that chair shape, it's not going to be as useful as a car or vice versa. Okay. So capital is heterogeneous. It is specific to the consumer goods being produced. Weirdly, this is something you have to explain to many mainstream economists. I actually had a discussion with one of the members of my dissertation committee I was trying to explain the Austrian capital theory, the business cycle theory. I said, well, you know, when interest rates go back up, usually the Fed's responding to inflation, so that means a bunch of capital gets wasted. And he said, well, why is it wasted? Because capital is specific, right? You start abandoning projects, you're abandoning specific projects that you can't just use for something else, right? But what did he have in mind, right? He had in mind this model, right, where capital is all potatoes, right? Okay, right, so we have too many potatoes laying around. We consume some more than we normally would. And then we plant fewer. That's fine. It's not a big deal. Right? Yeah, but capital's not all potatoes. Weirdly, I think I'm over-explaining this to this crowd, but I'd be under-explaining it if I were talking to PhD economists from most places. Okay. All right. So I think the right analogy, if we really want to think about capital and specificity, is to think about what would happen if we subsidized lead baseball factories. Right? Lead baseballs, I'd suggest, are not particularly useful to consumers, but I can imagine if you make the subsidy large enough, we're going to start building lead baseball factories. We'll hire people to produce lead baseballs. Eventually, though, we figure out that this is not a great use of resources. Right? And if those subsidies end, right, we would imagine that probably these lead baseball factories would shut down. Right? Kind of think this is a fair analogy to what happens during the Austrian business cycle theory. Right? We push down interest rates, that leads to us making all kinds of investments that really don't make sense in terms of satisfying consumer preferences. Right? Once things correct, interest rates go back up, we realize that, no, this isn't actually the best use of resources, so we abandon it and do something that's much more useful. But the result, though, is that once we give up those subsidies, or once the market starts correcting after the crisis in the business cycle, we have a lot of unused capital, right? Because capital is not potatoes. We have a lot of capital that's sitting around, basically not being used. Okay, and that's where what things look like once we hit the crisis, okay, or hit the other side of the crisis. This is the point where politicians start talking. Okay, right? Oh, right. We have a problem. Right? We need jobs. Right? All these people have been laid off from lead baseball factories. This is terrible. We need jobs. I would first suggest, just kind of as an aside, this is a really misdirected concern. Right? Personally, I'd be okay if I didn't have a job as long as I still had an income. I'm okay with free time. That doesn't bother me. I don't have cable, but there's a lot of stuff on Netflix that I still haven't watched. I can fill the time. Right? Right, so this lack of jobs I don't think should be in itself the concern, but that's what we talk about. These people equate jobs and income. Okay. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Okay. And so we need to create jobs. That's the big thing we need to push. And in order to create jobs, you know what we really need are shovel-ready projects. Right? This was a great phrase you heard all the time in 2008, just as the crisis was happening. Well, we're really going to focus stimulus on shovel-ready projects. Right? That is, projects that are ready to get off the ground, that we can start right away. We don't have to do all this planning, right, that would slow things down. We really want to get these jobs started right away. Right? So what kind of projects are shovel-ready, right, ready to get off the ground when you remove subsidies from that lead baseball factory? Right? Well, it ends up we have this nice empty lead baseball factory over here, right? We have lots of people that are already trained in making lead baseballs. Right? This would be great. All we need to do is have the government start buying lead baseballs, and we're good, right? We can stimulate the economy very well, create lots of jobs, and it's going to be exceptionally effective as stimulus. Okay. Right. Now, one point that comes out of this is that really, while we talk a lot about creating jobs, I know, not me personally, well, politicians talk a lot about creating jobs as stimulus, I don't know that's actually their only goal. In order to really demonstrate this, there's a story told by Milton Friedman. He was traveling in India, and he saw this project that was underway. He saw lots of workers here using shovels to dig a ditch. I guess it was a shovel-ready project. And he said to the government minister that was showing him around, he said, you know, you could do this a lot faster and a lot cheaper if you just invest in some heavy machinery. You can have it done in a day. It's very easy. And this minister said, oh, well, the purpose of this program is not just to dig the ditch, it's to provide jobs. Right? And Milton Friedman thought for a moment, said, well, then why aren't they using spoons? Right? Right? If we want to create jobs, let's do this as inefficiently as possible. Right? Which means we shouldn't use all this capital we already have built up. We need to start from scratch. Right? Let's find things we're not good at and focus on that. But I think politicians understand that really the purpose of the economy is actually to produce stuff, and they're not going to be able to convince the public as a whole that, well, we should just have people digging holes and filling them back in, and this actually works as stimulus. Right? That provides jobs, sure, very effectively, an infinite number of jobs over time, right? But people are going to be doubtful of this. But if I say things like, well, we have all this construction equipment from all these houses that we built that, you know, we were in a bubble, we really shouldn't have built them. Maybe we can take this construction equipment and build new government buildings. Right? Those are always useful. Right? We can build more roads and bridges, right? Replace all our crumbling roads and bridges. One of my favorite Obama lines, the crumbling roads and bridges. It's great. Okay. So we can do all of these things. And there are things that feel useful, right? Okay, yeah, I drive on roads. I would like for my roads not to crumble beneath my car. I can get behind that stimulus, right? Or, yeah, the collapsing bridges are a problem, certainly if you're on them while they're collapsing. So, yeah, let's make sure those are repaired, right? Suddenly it becomes, okay, not just about jobs. It's about other things as well. If you want additional proof, if you look at the stimulus of 2008, it was supposed to cost us right around $800 billion. Right? The claim was, this was, you know, a one-year program, $800 billion we're going to spend and create roughly 4 million jobs or so. 3 or 4 million jobs is the figure they gave. Now, fortunately, that is for the politicians, most people don't understand words that end in "-ilion." Anything that comes before the "-ilion," is just the "-ilion," right? Right, so we're spending 800 illion to get 4 illion. Right? Oh, sure, why not? Right? It doesn't mean anything. Right, but those that actually can do division with things where illion has something in front of it, will realize that 800 billion divided by 4 million is $200,000 for each job we're creating. Right? I wanted one of those jobs. But I would suggest they probably didn't pay $200,000. Why not? Right? The money wasn't going to create jobs. Right? It was going to build bridges, to build roads, to, you know, build monuments and what have you, rather than just creating jobs, which was the nominal goal. Okay. I'd actually suggest if we're going to spend $800 billion anyway, right, why not just write a $50,000 check to each of the 16 million people that were unemployed at the time, right? Okay, that's $50,000. That's pretty good. It'll get you through the year, probably, unless you have rather serious issues. I've lived on less than that most years that I've been working. Right, so we could have a much better public support program for the same price. Right? But we don't do that. Right? It's interesting. It's interesting. Because we understand, we don't want to obviously do things that are unproductive. We have to do things that look productive, right? Even if they may not be the best use of resources. Okay. And so if we're going to have actually effective stimulus, that is, that looks like it's producing something and at the same time is providing jobs, what we need to do is find those shovel-ready jobs, right, those shovel-ready projects, and bring them into production again. We need to find those lead baseball factories and start buying the lead baseballs. What does this do? Right? In the end, as Austrian economists, we understand the problem during the business cycle is that we misallocated capital. We put it into things that don't actually reflect consumer preferences. And then when we stimulate, what do? Well, the best, easiest, most effective way is going to be to stimulate exactly those projects that were misdirecting capital. And so it's not just the problem that's normal with government spending, where we're not really sure whether the market would provide the same thing anyway. Right? I like to believe that professors would still exist in a free market, that I'm not just a parasite existing off the state. Right? Yeah, I work with enough leftists. I don't think they mind me calling them at that either. So I say, okay, well, the tuition dollars my students pay, that pays my salary. Right? The state's paying all of the rest of you. Right? And I think they'd be fine with that, actually. Okay. All right, so the problem is with government spending, we don't really know, or how much of this is stuff the market would do anyway, right? Certainly, the market would probably hire me, right? But would we necessarily build this road in this place, right? Maybe it's run down because nobody really drives on it. It's not a huge deal, right? Maybe this road can be allowed to crumble, right? Maybe this bridge, you know, once we realize there are safety issues, we should abandon and just use the bridge that's a block or two down, right? We really don't know, right? Okay. And that's the problem, right? There are things that the government does that the market would do, right? So that's exactly why it's silly for those that like to ask us, well, who would build the roads? If you think roads are useless, nobody. Right? But if you think roads are useful, somebody is going to find it worthwhile to build a road. Right? Okay. As long as it's worth more than it costs. Right? With the government, they're going to do some of these things, but they're also going to do lots of things that are total waste. Right? And I suggest that if we think about errors and the way that affects investment, the way that affects the type of stimulus we want, right, we end up with the conclusion that stimulus projects are not going to fund those things the market would do anyway. Right? It's going to fund those things the market has actually decided not to do. Right? We're investing various resources in things the market has just rejected and declared as malinvestments and abandoned these particular capital projects. Okay. Right, so I'd suggest if we look back at the most recent crisis, right, we see things like, you know, bailouts for the financial sector. I think this probably has that same character. Right? Perhaps the financial sector had gotten overbloated before this. Right? Maybe some of the derivatives that were created didn't really need to exist and would not have existed, barring certain methods in the tax code, say. Right? Right? But then we go and we bail them out because we have people that are trained to do these things. We can't let banks fail. After all, far too important to allow that to happen. Or we have construction spending after the boom. Okay, so we have this big housing boom, lots of investment being made in capital equipment that's specific toward doing construction projects. Well, we can still use that. We'll just use it on other construction projects for the government. Right, so we see this exact type of pattern being played out over the most recent crisis. Okay. Another thing that I find rather disturbing is that when you really start thinking in the lead baseball factory way, you realize getting rid of these subsidies is going to be exceptionally difficult. Because as soon as we do, right, we collapse back into the recession. Right? Just as an example, right, we were told. Okay, if I can get the computer up again. Ah, I closed it. Oh, no. Is it going to come back awake? It may. We'll see. Oh, it's locked.
How locked is it?
Not very. I'm not important enough to know what the password is, but fortunately, I didn't need to.
All right.
There we go. One of the very disturbing things is that we were told it's $800 billion for a year, and then you look at what government deficits look like. Well, there we can see in 2008, if you add up over that year ending in 2009, right here, you can see the effect of the stimulus coming in. Over that time, and as you can see, the stimulus clearly disappeared a year later, as by the end of 2010, things were back up to normal. Right? And everybody's very confused. And you need to have your eyes tested again, Professor. That's not what it shows. It's not, right? Instead, it shows this $800 billion stimulus looks like it lasted not only $800 billion in 2008, but in 2009, another $800 billion, in 2010, another $800 billion managed just to become this normal thing, right? We stop subsidizing the lead baseball factory, and what happens? Right? So we have to keep it going if we're going to maintain, right, this view that, yes, things are okay, people have jobs, right? We have to keep paying $200,000 for each of these jobs, apparently. Okay. Right. So I would suggest that this is really the way we should think of government stimulus and that it's going to continue malinvestments that have already been declared malinvestments by the market. Okay. Now, there's a pretty standard defense here that come from those that are very influenced by Keynes that say something like, well, if we don't use stimulus, right, otherwise these resources are just going to sit idle. Right. The alternative is to just have the lead baseball factory sitting there empty. Right? And, you know, we've all driven past empty factories. And it's some combination of interesting and depressing for me. On the one hand, I drive by, I'm like, you know, I like to imagine what was it like when this was actually a useful factory. And then you look at it and see the broken windows and the faded paint and the graffiti, and you're a little bit sad, right? And so, otherwise, these resources are just going to sit idle and are going to end up here, and they're going to make Engelhardt depressed. Right? All right, so what we really need to do, it doesn't matter if we're doing anything that's really productive, as long as we're producing something that might possibly be useful. Right? That's what we should do. Right? We don't want to waste resources by just letting them sit around. Right? I would suggest that there's a difference, right, between resources waiting to be used well and resources sitting idle. Right. For example, I own a car, as most Americans do, right? And the grand majority of the time my car is sitting either on a parking lot or in my driveway. Right? Is it just wasted while it's there? Right. I don't think it is. Right. Because what that buys me is the flexibility to go where I want when I want to. Right. What I'm doing is buying myself, in effect, a certain insurance policy against uncertainty. Right. With where I live, it's quite a pain to get a taxi out there. I'm out in the suburbs. There aren't really taxis driving by my house on a regular basis. Right. So it's going to take forever if I had to call for a taxi. I certainly don't have buses that run by anytime soon. Right. Nor would they necessarily go anywhere I want to go. Right? But it's very easy for me to pick up my keys, walk out to my car, start up the van, and away I go. Right? Right, so what I'm effectively doing is buying an insurance policy against the uncertainty of whether or not I want to use my car at any particular point in time. Right? And I would suggest that that's actually basically the same role that these allegedly idle resources play right after the crisis. Right? We have all these resources. They are there. They may potentially be useful in some way, but it may take us time, right, to figure out exactly what we want to do with them, right? What is the best use for this lead baseball factory? Right? Yes, it's true it was specific to making lead baseballs, but there are other things we could potentially do with it with some conversion. We just have to figure it out. Right? And it takes time, right? We all know, right, thinking takes a certain amount of time. It's not an instantaneous thing. It's actually Arnold Kling suggested that the way we should think about a recession is really it's entrepreneurs taking some time to think, right? We've just made a bunch of mistakes. Right? We need to figure out what of this was actually a mistake, right? And what of this, what then can we do now with what we've done? Right? Right? We probably don't want to leave this factory abandoned. Maybe we do. Right? Maybe it's not worth converting. But there may be something there that is worth converting. It takes time to do the math and figure out what are things going to look like going forward. Right? We have to correct our foresight going ahead. We have to sort out all those bad entrepreneurs, they need to be removed from the market. That takes time, right, for us to figure all of this out. Okay, so I'd suggest that the answer to this idea that, well, these resources will just sit idle otherwise is that they're not just idle. Right, that they're waiting for us to find the right use. Right? And it may, in fact, be better, and I'd suggest it is, in fact, better for them to wait for the right use than to immediately get pushed into what we know is a wrong use. Especially because you go a step further, and entrepreneurs are going to respond to the signals the market gives them. Right? And when the government is hopping into the market, right, okay, some of these signals are actually the government providing noise. Right? So if the government's buying up all of these lead baseballs, as an entrepreneur running the lead baseball factory, this sure feels like a good use of resources to me. I'm making money, I'm earning profits, they're all artificial, just supported by the subsidies. Right? But it feels good to me. Right? Which means I have very little reason to think about what is the right use for these resources. Right? So we add noise as well while we are trying to make these things, you know, not set idle. That is, not wait till we find the right use of resources. Okay, so that's all I have here, which leaves actually lots of time. What, maybe 20 minutes or so for questions. There we go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of amazing, right, what people are willing to take credit for. it was really President Bush that gave us this huge deficit, right? All right, there it is, right? Oh, but we managed to decrease the deficit. That's great, right? When it was allegedly supposed to be this one-year thing, well, keep around a couple more years. We don't mention that, right? Yeah. Oh, and then we allowed part of it to go away, and that was an improvement. Yeah. Sure. I think that the story you're telling is true, right? That, just to repeat it in case you didn't hear it across the room, right, the story being that, you know, entrepreneurs are doing the best they can, right? There's a certain amount of uncertainty that's naturally involved. And as entrepreneurs use their judgment to do the best they can, interest rates are part of that judgment process, right? So if the interest rate lies in effect because of monetary policy, right, then entrepreneurs are going to do worse than they otherwise would. I think that that's a fair description of reality. But it does fall prey in some way, right, to the rational expectations critique of the Austrian business cycle theory. Right? Where those that are not familiar with this critique, there are some people, Brian Kaplan is one that likes to make this kind of argument, that says, basically say, well, you Austrians think entrepreneurs are so great at what they do typically. Right? Why is it they're fooled by low interest rates? And if you're a really good entrepreneur, right, you'll understand the Austrian business cycle theory. You'll understand these low interest rates will not last, and you'll take that into account. Right? Which I think that phrase might actually be exactly what Brian Kaplan says. Like, you take this into account. So kind of I like the Baxendale and Evans story because it answers why don't entrepreneurs take that into account. It might be that some do, right? Yeah. Right, exactly, exactly. So we have this set of entrepreneurs. Some are really good and actually might operate the way Kaplan says. Right? Some, though, are not so good and will operate much more the way Mises says. And my guess is, right, we bring in enough because of monetary expansion. We're going to bring in more entrepreneurs than we had before. Right? We're picking up all these low-quality people. Right? Even if the high-quality drop out, right, that just makes theirs worse and more common. Right? Yeah. Yeah, Kyle.
Ah, mm-hmm. A fairly good explanation for why you have high quality sellers selling to low quality buyers. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like it's particularly good at accounting for the intermediary there. But unless you're assuming that large numbers of new banks, which are less capable than old banks, and system, doesn't explain why otherwise good institutions would suddenly start favoring low interest rates.
Right. Right, right. Yeah, and I think that's a fair objection to what I'm saying. Is, you know, more or less, to sum it up and tell me if this is fair, you know, why did the banks suddenly get lousy at sorting out, you know, good from bad borrowers? So they're lending to all these lousy borrowers. Is that fair? Yeah. Yeah, I think there are answers to that. Probably one of the best is that, you know, banks know that they're not operating on their own in a sense. If things go poorly, it's reasonable, right, for us to expect that we're going to get some kind of bailout. Right? So as long as I'm big and important enough, right, I'll be fine. We can also add to that kind of the structure of the financial system, and that a lot of information got covered up in the process and the way things were working 10 years ago as the bubble was getting started. You know, you have loans being originated but not being held by the originating company. So I don't particularly care what the quality's like as long as I get my fee. And if we package this in the right way, like put it into a mortgage-backed security, okay, now diversification is working for us. I don't care about any particular one loan if I buy the security. On the whole, there's no way that housing prices are all going to fall everywhere. Right, right. We haven't seen it happen for a long time. Right. Right. So I think we can explain that away on that basis. Information getting covered up plus the expectation of bailouts making us less careful. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To your point, I remember I was actually debating with my friend about the existence of moral hazards.
Sure.
He's a finance type that said, oh, you're just being too theoretical. And then I found a stat form that
Yeah, sure.
So if I was able to find that easily, I'm pretty sure someone at Goldman Sachs could find that much more easily.
Sure. Yeah, it's not shocking to me at all. Right? You know, only paying attention to the U.S. and only in my lifetime, you know, both major banking crises, we saw rather significant bailouts. Right? So, yeah, it's not surprising that it's true. It's a little bit depressing that it's true.
These were widely varied in size. But
sure.
Anything that I guess would seem too big to fail by their local government or whatever.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I believe that. It's interesting. Yeah, over here. Yeah, back here first.
So that, I think, that also lures in the good entrepreneurs and keep up with the competitors and hopefully get out to the
customers. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that actually brings to mind actually kind of a slightly different story, what we call information cascades. Right? And it would help to explain further why the bad entrepreneurs would get drawn in at such a time. Right? An information cascade is basically where you have a bunch of ignorant people that end up making the same kinds of decisions, right? As a result of basically herd behavior. Right? So the way that I imagine information cascades is you're driving along in the middle of nowhere on this little road, and there are these two restaurants on either side of the road. Right? Neither of them have anybody there. Right? But the first car that comes along says, well, I don't know who has the better burgers, right? Joe's or Bob's. So I'm just going to pick one and flip a coin, right? And go there. The second person comes along and says, oh, well, I see that there's somebody at Joe's. There's nobody at Bob's. Maybe Joe's is where I should go, right? So then they go there. Third person comes along, oh, everybody seems to prefer, right, Joe's versus Bob's, whatever it happens to be. And we end up everybody piling into the place that has bad burgers. Right, okay. And it's just because of this lack of information, right, and just acting as if other people are more informed. Right? And I could definitely see that happening, say, over the course of the boom. Right? Oh, I don't know anything, but somebody that's a good investor is really advertising that they're investing in this particular thing. I come in along a little bit later. If they very quietly sell it, right, I don't sell. Right? So I could see that adding to this process as well. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just going to say, do you think that, well, there's obviously the bailout deal where it's cares, but also knowing that there's going to be this huge inflow of money coming in, do you think they're like, well, regardless of how bad we think it is, we are going to have to get in on this in the beginning, regardless, and then they just don't ever really get out? Or like in the housing, everything was securitized together, so it really ended up not mattering.
Right. Yeah. I think it's certainly true. Once you throw in bailouts to effectively eliminate the downside, right, you need to participate in the upside at that point. And it doesn't make any sense not to either. So, yeah, I think that's the bailouts play a very important role. And then you throw in competitive pressure. Yeah, I can see that being worse. Yes.
Here's the way I can understand. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, like Wells Fargo, they can care less about, you know, as long as you meet certain criteria, they're going to sell, you know, they're going to sell the loan right after they get into it. A lot of the problem happened was when they got converted over to derivatives, because the way those work, as far as I understand, is it's not just your loan bunched in. It's like your loan from this year to this year, and it's like micro slices of all these different things.
Sure.
And, when you did it that way, I mean, I don't think the banks even understood what was in there. Some of them were very toxic because you have all these things mixed in, and you know, people invest in it not knowing what they're getting. And,
right. Sure. I can't speak to the specific structure of these derivatives. I don't know exactly. Just throwing a bunch of mortgages. It might be. What's that?
I don't think anybody
can. No. That might be part of the point, possibly. Right. But my inclination is to say that a big part of the story is that, you know, a lot of the specific information got lost in that process. Right. But at the same time, when we have the view, largely because of the rational expectations kind of view and the efficient markets hypothesis, but really what all this is pushing at us is that we just need to diversify. You're going to do as well as you can in terms of risk. Right? So if we have the perception that these securities are really well diversified, right? Okay, yes, all this information is lost, but it doesn't matter. Right? And so on the one hand, information got lost. On the other hand, I don't care. So it makes it perfectly marketable. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Example, 2008 financial crisis without interest rates, because the FDIC, even though they lowered their credit expansion, the requests were still relatively high. Even in 2010, the Q4 reported that only 12% of had problem, like the banks.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other theory? Because like the business cycle theory, it's more than just interest rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to think. So what specifically are you asking about then? Yeah.
Other factors, well, you know, excluding interest rates.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like led into the crisis then. Yeah, I think there's naturally a combination of things. I'm one that would say that, you know, interest rates were a very important spark to get things started. And it also was a very important bucket to make things end right once the fire got started. Right? Interest rates dropped and suddenly everyone was caught and buy houses. But there were other things happening. Certainly once we start seeing housing prices go up, right, people start forming expectations based on that. Banks start forming expectations based on that. Right? So it makes it more likely for me to go out and try to get a loan, makes it more likely for the loan to look acceptable to the bank. That all would play in. There's also reasonable evidence. Weirdly, if you look at the absolutely horrible report that's put together by Congress about the financial crisis. I forget what it was, like the report on the financial crisis, something like that. You watch very closely requirements for lending to certain preferred groups, say lower incomes and the like. Banks match those very, very closely. Right? They would anticipate a little bit. There were laws being passed in the late 90s, early 2000s, increasing the requirements for giving certain types of loans, right? Specifically to those borrowers that may be less qualified by standard measures. And banks seem to follow those almost to the letter. Right? So it seems like that was also driving part of it as well, where these requirements, these regulatory requirements coming in, right? And specifically lending to these specific borrowers that were not creditworthy in the end. So yeah, I think getting things started, there was a lot of stuff happening. I'd say that interest rates tell us there's going to be some kind of boom somewhere. Add in the other institutional factors, like these regulations in the housing mortgage markets. I think that makes it more likely it shows up at that place at that time, right? That's what I would say. And then later on, I guess you add in the fact that a lot of these were adjustable rate mortgages that ended up being relatively easy to sell to people that didn't know any better, right? Then interest rates go up and people can't afford their houses anymore. And so it's relatively easy to see how that all unfolds. I can afford my house now. If they doubled my mortgage payment, I couldn't possibly afford it. Right. So I think, yeah, interest rates play a key role in getting things started. And at the end, the way things play out, you know, are affected by other things. Sure. Yeah.
Well, it seems like the author agreed that this was a pretty good job of explaining what's going on. So is there anything really in Keynesian understanding that you know, is as comprehensive, or is
Right. Yeah. Actually, interestingly, if you look at, there's a line of post-Keynesian thought that follows Hyman Minsky was the guy's name. If you read a lot of what he does, after things get started, he sounds very Austrian in that it's largely debt that's fueling these speculative bubbles that eventually have to burst. It's just at that spark point where there's that difference, and he's much more Keynesian and saying, well, you know, people go crazy and decide to start buying houses, and that gets the ball rolling, versus the Austrian story of it's bad monetary policy that leads people to start buying houses. But otherwise, the dynamics look very similar, which I think helps to explain why, you know, when people start saying things are going to go bad, you know, Paul Krugman doesn't do that bad at forecasting. Because once things are started, right, okay, he's basically operating on almost the same basis that we are. But if you get the explanation for why it started wrong, you give totally wrong policy prescriptions at the end, right? So that's how I would kind of explain why is it Krugman can forecast reasonably well. Right? He misses some parts of the theory, but not all, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So with the rates still being kind of held low,
yeah.
What do you see happening from that? Are they going to be ignored because kind of like Japan, or is it going to be?
I'm not a very good entrepreneur. Remember that $1.19. So, you know, I would advise you not to take my 2 cents because I don't have that many of them, right? but if I were to throw it out there, that's hard to say. At this point, I think in terms of quote-unquote real economic activity, I don't know that we're seeing the low interest rates affect a lot right now, just because I think there's so much uncertainty. Right? There's a lot of hesitance to really jump in on big investments. But we are seeing the stock market do very well. Right? So financial markets are doing quite well. It's not obvious to me why that would be, apart from the fact that there's a lot of money flowing into the economy. It has to go somewhere. Right? If I don't want to build a factory, well, where do I invest it? So it's kind of what I would think is that at the moment, it's really the stock markets is where this is showing up, which would suggest when interest rates start going back up, we can expect a correction there, would be my guess. I'm uncertain enough that I'm not really putting my own money behind what I just said. So I'm not out there shorting stocks at this point, in part because I can't predict Janet Yellen to save my life. So I don't know when she's going to say, okay, let's go ahead and start raising rates. I have no clue. Right. And also, I know myself well enough that I could be very, very wrong as well in where things are going to show up. Okay. So, yeah, as much as I don't like the efficient market hypothesis and the implications regarding diversification and all of that, it does actually work for really lousy entrepreneurs like me. The best I can do is just not make horrible errors by investing in everything. Yeah. If everything goes down, well, okay, I'm going to be screwed regardless. Yeah.
Like, I mean, if you use the base and like change a few adjustments and just make a few minor adjustments, then it works great.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But
yeah.
If you start reasoning from a faulty premise, then.
Right. Right. Yeah, one thing to Krugman's credit is that he does watch the data very closely, right? And I guess one of the realities of, I guess, economic life is that in normal times, times are normal, right? So the economy is not that hard to predict 90% of the time, right? You take GDP from last year, you add 3%, you're going to be close, right? What's really hard to predict is when things turn the other way, right? When things are unusual, and that's when it's most important to predict, right? And so, yeah, it's interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He gets on Main Street Regattas, right? Always assuming a Gaussian distribution,
right.
And the thin tails, and then, well, once you're operating in the fat tails,
right? Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I actually have, when I teach money and banking, I talk a little bit about forecasting and just showing a very basic, okay, let's do an econometric model where one quarter's GDP is predicted by the previous quarter's GDP, and that's it, right? And you end up with an R-squared of like 0.99. Right? It's exceptionally high, right? But then when you look at when the errors happen, right? Oh, here's the crisis, right? Here's this other recession, right? Here's this unusual growth period, right? All the times that are interesting are the times you get wrong when you do this, right? Which I think is an interesting thing, and yeah. I like Taleb in that regard. The most important times are the times that were in those tails. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed that the only economist he actually consulted about his book, The Black Swan, were the Austrians at NYU.
Sure. Yeah, that is, it's interesting. Yeah, certainly. Other questions? All right. In that case, thank you very much. Sure.